Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, February 4th, 2010. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, the Layman's Guide to Mind Control. I want to make sure you get a complete overview. This is a big topic, so I anticipate that we're going to go more than an hour, up to an hour and a half. I hope you can stay on. If not, just dial in and get the recording to complete it. We'll have it up by tomorrow afternoon. Our movie's telethon and mentoring candidate will be part of the mind control discussion rather than a separate let's go to the movies. But first, let me review the stories in Money and Markets and some questions for Ask Catherine. Money and Markets. The theme this week is that the war over total economic return finally emerges. Let me explain what I mean by that. I put up a post at the blog a couple months ago. It's called the Solari Model - Total Economic Return. If you do a search, you can find it. And it's from a paper I wrote for an investment firm in London and published in 2002. And in it, it describes the current model and my proposal for how we could change the investment model on planet Earth to solve many of the problems that we're dealing with. Essentially, what I do is I describe that an investment, whether it's an investment by a person or by a state and local or federal government or by a private entity, any investment has a total economic return, and that's its complete impact on the financial ecosystem in which it impacts. And you can divide that total economic return into two returns. One is the return to the investor, and the other is the return to the network. So let's say I build a convention center in our county, and the investors who finance it get a return on their investment, but then it has an impact to everybody else in the county, and that's the return to the network, and the two in combination are the total economic return. And either one can be positive or negative. So the investors could make money, but the network and everybody impacted could lose money. So that's an Enron. Not all the investors made money, but sort of the core guys who played the game. And, so they both can be positive or they both can be negative. And the key issue for any sort of financial and economic system is, are investors getting a return in a way that's positive for the total economic return and for the network, or negative? And what we saw emerge this week was a real debate between, on one hand, you have Geithner and Summers, Geithner out front, the Secretary of the Treasury. And these are guys, Geithner and Summers are people who came up, they're sort of the water boys for the traders. They're the ones that kept derivatives unregulated. They're the ones that got Glass-Steagall deregulated and have helped the traders make huge and hideous amounts of money in ways that are very, very destructive for the real economy. And they've grown up in a bell jar. They're sort of younger in the scheme of things. And as far as it's, they think that making money in a system that's rigged by insider trading and government money is somehow, creating economic value. It's not. It's deleting. When you shift your capital out of the real economy and into a casino, you have a negative return to the network and a negative total economic return, even though the investors are making big bucks. On the other side, you've got Volcker, who realizes, is much older, is much wiser, understands about the importance of the real economy, and if you destroy everything, then there's nothing left for the casino to eat while they're churning their paper around. And so you sort of have the trader water boys and the kids versus Volcker. And we have the Volcker rule being proposed, with Volcker saying, we've got to stop all this speculative behavior and big bonuses as a result of the speculative trading, because it's destroying wealth in the economy. It's not creating any wealth. We've given huge and hideous amounts of money to these people, and all they're doing with it is things that just make things worse. Now, what you're watching is the bankers really just don't get it. They keep proposing more bonuses and speculative earnings. AIG paid out $100 million in bonuses. And I think they're going to be pretty much stunned by the pushback that's coming through, and it started. Martin Armstrong had a financial analyst who's now writes from prison, had a wonderful explanation and said, a lot of these people, for example, at Goldman Sachs, Lloyd Blankfein and some of his deputies, rose up at J. Aaron in the commodities markets. J. Aaron was a commodities firm that Goldman bought, and they've brought their sort of cowboy ways from the commodities markets, and they don't understand they're playing in a different game, and they're playing with government money and federal credit, and so you can't, you know, you can't kind of behave that way. There was a story today up on the blog in Top Picks. Bank chairmen in England have literally gone to the government and said, we need help with the antitrust issues, because if we're going to coordinate to cut back bonuses, and we have to coordinate or else we're going to end up picking each other off for employees, and it's, you know, it's going to get worse, you know, it's going to make things worse, not better, then we have to collaborate, and they're real antitrust issues. So it's going to be, you know, you're beginning to see some wise heads realize that there's trouble. Now, Dan Geithner, I never cease to be amazed at some of these things. Tim Geithner this week took credit for the strong dollar policy, which shows you the level of ignorance we're dealing with. The strong dollar policy was basically an engineered bubble that was allowed to withdraw from America a great deal of capital, all in a way that kept people in the dark about what was going on. So the fact that he's standing up and taking public credit for this, just as people are now beginning to realize that their retirement savings are in jeopardy or are gone, you know, is pretty astonishing. Remember, it's the pension funds that are holding the bag on a lot of the toxic assets, because you know, because pension funds are not leveraged like banks. They don't run into the same troubles. We've bailed out the banks. We didn't bail out the pension funds. So Geithner's sort of example of really being clueless about what the bigger game is a little bit scary. His testimony and the testimony on AIG last week was even more scary. It was so bad that even Bloomberg posted an article calling it evidence of a secret banking cabal. And it turns out that the deal was much sweeter for Goldman than even any of us knew. The $10 billion that Goldman picked up through the bailout of AIG turns out not to be the total limit. A lot of the foreign banks who were also bailed out were holding paper that Goldman had sold them. And so, in fact, it's very possible they were directly or indirectly liable for a bigger amount. Anyway, the thing that's going to bring the total economic return story home this year is unemployment. There are more announcements about rising unemployment this week and today. Last year, a lot of the corporate earnings announced were bought with layoffs. And finally, we have Wall Street investment analyst Diane Garnickel from Invesco saying our problem is, quote, unemployed people don't spend money. Now, why it took 15 years to get to that is quite amazing. For 15 years, we've been liquidating our equity. Now that we've finished liquidating our equity, I guess it's time to deal with the issue of how we're going to generate fundamental economic value sufficient to cover the cost. But I did say in the wrap-up, sort of story at the beginning of this year, that this year's story would be unemployment. And sure enough, the unemployment numbers hit today on top of the real fears around the sovereign debt problems. And it's important to realize that the unemployment story, we have to go through the state and local budget cycle, the layoffs from that, and the additional retail layoffs that are going to spin out of those layoffs, and the additional problems in the housing market and how that's going to impact unemployment. So the unemployment story is going to be with us, and it's just begun. Now, if you look at what spooked the market was probably more spooked by the sovereign debt problems, and we'll talk a little bit about those in a second. Obama is clearly under attack, and it's only going to get much worse. He seems to be bearing it all well, considering the size of the trap he's now in and his surprising, you know, low approval ratings, not surprising for the situation, but pretty low for after 1 year. What he's managing in his constituencies is a group of what's increasingly being called in the press rent seekers, looking for more subsidies. So lots of talk about higher taxes. So here we have a government which is doing everything it can to destroy the economy, and now it's looking for higher taxes on the productive higher taxes on income, higher taxes on capital gains, some of it just from not renewing the Bush tax cuts. Talk in London and here of taxing banker bonuses. And now we have Geithner proposing higher taxes on hedge funds. There was a great announcement this week, story in Bloomberg. Germany is considering buying stolen bank data related to Swiss banks, German depositors who have been evading taxes. Now, if governments continue to buy stolen data from bank employees, I mean, data that was criminally garnered, it's going to make the transparency process much more interesting, and it's going to lead to some very serious geopolitics. But we are watching government versus the banks. We saw Italy seizing assets from Bank of America. It appears that the derivative deals, the bum derivative deals with municipalities that we've seen seriously hurting, if not bankrupting, counties and municipalities around the United States, also happen throughout Europe, and you now have European municipalities with amazing derivative commitments that they can't possibly fund. So watch, that battle between the banks and sovereign governments emerge. We also saw at the World Economic Forum in Davos real bitterness break out between non-banker elites and the banker elites. It's kind of funny, elites getting mad at each other. But you can imagine how the folks who are not bankers, after all the bailouts, are feeling about their banker, their fellow banker members in the World Economic Forum getting massively big bonuses, much bigger than they're getting last year. So, the bankers are starting to feel the heat. And to me, it's only just begun. The markets dropped all week. Today was really a drop. Global equity markets dropped 2 to 3% with the Dow just holding the line above 10,000 at 10,002. Oil and gold down about 5%. So commodities down more. There really are real fears about the sovereign debts. And the funny thing is, we have everything real going down in value with the dollar going up. Of course, if you look at the economic news, it's the dollar that should be going down. But it's a very interesting way to force people to sell real things cheap and then turn around and use their money to finance you buying the real things up cheap. So it's the ultimate in economic warfare. But we've seen this happen before. We're going to see it happen again. Every time the dollar starts to fall too much, you get a huge whack, a variety of different techniques used to push the dollar the other way. And the danger we run is, if you think of a planet like a house, and the house has an appraised value of $1 million, and it's got a mortgage of $1.5 million, and the equity is trading in the open market at $100,000, then it doesn't take much to figure that the debt overhang could whack the equity at every time. And that's what we've seen. We've seen the global equity and commodities markets get hit whenever the dollar and the bond market, which is certainly the mother of all markets next to the currency market, start to weaken. So, expect to protect the dollar and the bond markets that the equity markets are going to be at risk every time. We saw, just as the markets really start to fall out of bed, we see the CIA announcing that Al-Qaeda will definitely attack sometime in the next 3 to 6 months. It's interesting, whenever we start to get a serious financial meltdown, suddenly Al-Qaeda, magically appears, and they did again. The reports from Haiti are exceedingly ugly. The U.S. continues to look like it's grabbing resources, and they're very rich oil and mineral resources in and around Haiti. They look like they're invading rather than providing relief. And my prediction is that the picture of disaster capitalism that's going to emerge over the next few years from what's happening in Haiti now are going to be far worse than even we saw in the Indonesian tsunami or Katrina. The disaster capitalism is growing leaps and bounds, and part of it is, I get back to what I said earlier, the rent seekers seeking, you know, something that they can still harvest, and so watch disaster capitalism grow. To a certain extent, part of what I'm talking when I refer to the sort of bounce the dollar's getting right now, I call it the Haiti bounce. And part of it is it's a reminder to everybody of the force that the United States military can bring to bear if they need to. A big event in the last 2 weeks is the shock of the new budget. The contingent liabilities are finally beginning to move into the annual budget, and the shock of what amount of money is going to be needed to finance just current expenditures is sort of coming home to roost. We now have a budget showing major deficits. Depends on who you talk to, how you count them, and they don't even include Fannie and Freddie. We have a number of people in Congress and the administration admitting that Fannie and Freddie are never, you know, are going to remain on the government balance sheet, but they're not included in the budget. They're being held off budget. You know, it's kind of a big Enron game. And there's no plan and no end game, and it's part of what's got everybody nervous about the housing market. An announcement today that U.S. healthcare is now 50% government funded. That's a frightening number. The big debt fears this week were not in the United States. They were in Europe. It's part of what's got the dollar rising against the euro and European currencies. And the sort of conversation in Europe about who's going to help Greece, Spain, Portugal, and some of the other sovereign debt cleanups. So the talk is Europe this week, but if you look at the numbers on the state and local governments, you know, no good pointing our finger at Europe, because the same conversation is going to be here, certainly with a vengeance, by summer. I put up on the blog the borrowings to date of the unemployment compensation funds of some of the states. If you look at the borrowing that California is doing for its unemployment compensation fund, it's off the charts, and their deficit is approaching just enormous numbers. How they're going to balance the books, we don't know. But the prior budget director on his way out suggesting that they look at what would happen if California became part of the federal government is not a ridiculous option to contemplate when you look at the numbers. So we also saw this week enormous pronouncements of growth, big headlines in the Wall Street Journal about growth and how well things are doing. It's not catching on, though, because the part of the economy that's hurting, you know, is catching up and is going to spiral back into the other economy. It's really the citizens versus the big corporations. And the citizens really are hurting too much, and it's gonna affect everything. Meantime, the fight for resources is playing out, you know, even more meanly in geopolitics. There's a lot of rattling of the saber by the United States with regards to what's going on in Iran. My prediction is that's to sort of quell Israel's concerns, but I just don't see that going to war yet. You know, let's see what happens, but to me, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of dancing, but Russia and China are going to make it very difficult for very serious sanctions or going to war in Iran, but, you know, and so the question is, can the United States mollify and control Israel? In the meantime, we see tensions with China continuing to grow, sanctions being threatened by China for big sales of arms to Taiwan by some of the biggest defense contractors, Boeing and Lockheed. We now have an announcement today. Google is partnering with the NSA to get to the bottom of the cyber attacks from China and to deal with those kind of cyber attacks. And Google openly and obviously partnering with the NSA. You know, I don't even want to discuss where that could go. Change is going to accelerate more between now and the end of the quarter. And more people, a lot of it is more people starting to realize the facts of resource limitations and how profoundly non-aligned different groups are. When you have an economic model that has a negative total economic return, in other words, you're making money from doing things that harm other people, that harm the environment, you have a lot of fundamental disagreements, you know, you have a win-lose model. There are a lot of win-lose going on, and until we build new alignments, that's going to keep happening. And so as people start to realize that the, you know, that issuing more debt and more bubbles can't push that question of resource limitations and how to build alignments any further out into the future, you're going to have a dawning, a realization that there really is fundamental change underway. So it's just good to stay fluid. If we continue to grind through it, we may, but there's still the possibility that the other shoe could drop the way it did. It started to, and then 2008 got stopped. A couple things to keep your eye on. One is weather. We have we've had very harsh weather. It's the lowest winter wheat crop for a long time. But sort of record low crops for the winter, and tough impact on life and people, particularly when you're struggling economically. So keep an eye on the weather. The other thing to keep an eye on is the Pentagon and sort of that world, the defense contractors and the intelligence community. Their power is going to rise as the bankers' power diminishes, and they're used to being invisible or relatively invisible given their power. So it's going to be interesting to see if they can remain so under the circumstances. And again, as I said, unemployment's going to increase this year by a lot. And the question remains, you know, kind of hangs in the air, unspoken and unanswered, which is, what's the plan? There are a lot of sort of fake and false solutions that are getting bandied about. But what we're starting to see is the beginning of real conversations at the state and local level, and sort of in regional and global networks that are going to grow. And that's positive, particularly if it links up with the conversation at the sort of at the national level about, are we going to run the financial system so that it has a positive total economic return or a negative economic return? And whatever his influence or whatever happens, I think Volcker's presence is going to be very positive in that respect. Finally, our hero of the week, Eustace Mullen. If you don't know about Eustace Mullen, we'll put the obit up on the blog by tomorrow morning, and it's someone you want to learn about. Eustace Mullen, as a young man, started to work at the Library of Congress and got hooked up with Ezra Pound when he'd been slammed into St. Elizabeth's Mental Hospital in Washington, and got himself, as a young man, quite an education on how the world really works, and ended up dedicating a lifetime to writing lots of books and pamphlets and articles about how things really are, sort of a true American history. And he died on February 2nd. And if you want to, if you're somebody who aspires to have the definitive library on how the world really works in American history, now's the time to go out and buy one of, you know, every book that Eustace Mullen ever wrote. They're really a treasure, and his life is a testimony to somebody who really did make an enormous difference. Ask Catherine. Three quick questions. Coping with retirement. If you are already retired and dependent on interest income, how do you cope after cutting expenses? Should you invest in the stock market, in bonds, in gold, or in annuities to possibly increase your return even with a concurrent risk? Now, I don't like giving investment advice, and each person's situation is unique truly, so it's really not appropriate to make these kinds of generalities, but let me try and make a few that I can make. One is anything you can do to invest your money that will permanently lower your overhead or reduce your dependency on the system is very, very good. So you all have heard me tell the story of taking your money out of the stock market so you can build a well and permanently lower your water bill. I was sitting, we had a huge ice storm in Tennessee, and sure enough, the the power went out, and I had bought a one of those generators that comes on automatically and had no problem, thank heavens. And so, you know, my money was much better sitting in the generator than it was sitting in any investment. So anything you can do to invest your money so that you're more self-sufficient, more resilient, and don't need to generate an income, please consider it. And that includes building much more, much larger inventories of tangible, non-perishable things that you're really going to use in the next year or two than we normally do. And then what I would say is real things are going to continue to increase in value relative to paper. Now, that doesn't mean that there isn't going to be immense volatility because the paper is going to fight back. I put up a post on the blog over the last week called Meditations on Financial Volatility, and I talk about this very issue. So whatever you invest in, if you're investing in real things, particularly if they're liquid, they're, you know, you're going to have to manage much greater volatility than any of us are used to. But I really encourage you to read about that and think about that and learn how to manage your affairs so that that kind of volatility is not a problem. And there are ways to do it. The second question relates to gun plans. Could you please discuss how long you believe individuals can remain free if their right to protect themselves is taken away? I think it is extremely important. If you look at the history of totalitarianism, one of the most dangerous things that people can do is to give up their right to bear arms. And so I think the right to bear arms and having a well-armed population is incredibly important and valuable. And I think if we give up that right, we can watch a lot move against us. And it's not just, Will we lose our civil rights? But when you are dependent and have no power, if you have no leverage, it makes it much easier to do things like confiscate IRA or 401ks or increase capital control. So being well armed impacts not just our freedoms, but the value of our assets and our ability to protect our assets. Now, when I talk about mind control, what you're going to learn is that the technologies that now exist to subdue a crowd or a person or a population are the techniques to sort of overcome even a well-armed population are there and growing. So it's important not to think that just because everybody has a gun that things are going to be okay, because the world is very different now than it was 50 years ago. So we'll talk about that more under mind control. And finally, Catherine, this article in New Scientist is about how a particular drug company peddles meds around the globe by selling Western ideas of mental illness and convincing entire cultures that they are depressed. I love this question. You know, one of the things, if you ever read some of the stuff the Scientologists write about, drugs, or the invention of mental illness, and the use of drugs to address mental illness is sort of a conspiracy by the bankers to destroy the world. It's one place where I really do agree with the Scientologists. And every time I say that, I get whacked by somebody. But the reality is there's absolutely no, if you look for scientific proof of mental illness, there is none. Now, clearly we've all dealt with, whether it's ourselves or other people, who've had real problem, mental problems. So I'm not saying that we don't have mental problems, but I do think that the idea of mental illness is, and drugs to solve it is being over-applied in ways which are frightening. And I will tell you one of my favorite stories. I had I was listening to a tape somebody down here gave me of their favorite preachers, a well-known preacher in the South, and he was talking about his first sermon. He decided he graduated from seminary and was assigned to a church and decided his first sermon would be on faith. And as he prepared his sermon, he thought about, well, who do I know that has the most faith, the strongest faith, the best faith of anyone I know. And he realized his mother, who had raised him and his brother alone in the Depression, a single woman with two kids and sort of, you know, little way to earn a living. And yet he could never remember seeing her unhappy or scared or, you know, she just demonstrated an enormous faith under adversity. So he called her and he said, you know, Mom, I'm writing a sermon of faith, and I realize that you're the person who's evidenced the most faith of anyone I've ever known. And I want to know how you did it. How did you raise two kids in a depression, you know, under very difficult economic circumstances and just never show any fear or, you know, just be loving and positive the whole time? How did you do it? His mother thought a long time, and she said, well, you know, son, that was before psychology. Anyway, so, yeah, I think that a lot of the peddling of mental illness and the notion of depression and the use of a lot of drugs, not all, is really not a positive step. And in fact, many of the people I know who are depressed because they have very good reason to be depressed. And depression is sort of a signal that there's something really, really wrong. And the way to figure out, you know, real solutions is to look at, okay, what's really, really wrong, and fix it. Because a lot of the things that have people depressed are, you know, as one psychiatrist said, real crosswires in the power lines of society. And you can't fix that depression within the person. You have to deal with those power lines. Okay, well, speaking of real power lines and crosswires in the power lines of society, we arrive at A Layman's Guide to Mind Control. Now, what is mind control? Mind control, and I'm going to use a definition from one psychologist, sort of edited by me. Mind control is a process in which a person or a group of people, or an enterprise systematically uses unethical or illegal methods to persuade or force one or more people to conform to the wishes of the manipulators, often to the detriment of and without the conscious knowledge of the person being manipulated. So let me say that again. Mind control is a process in which a person, group, or enterprise systematically uses unethical or illegal methods to persuade or force one or more people to conform to the wishes of the manipulators, often to the detriment of and without the conscious knowledge of the person being manipulated. Now, as a subtext to mind control, one of the important things to understand, if you said to me, just as a financial person, what is the most profitable business in the history of the world? I would probably say that slavery is the most profitable business, even more profitable than warfare, because you, oddly enough, you can't get to warfare without slavery. But the most profitable kind of slavery is slavery in which the slave does not know that they are the slave, and you can literally use the slave's mind to achieve the slavery without sort of visible coercion and force. And so the economics of mind control are unbelievably compelling, unbelievably, just as a pure financial matter. So why is understanding mind control important to you? I first realized this. I was we used to have an old forum that was up in public, and somebody brought up mind control, and another person got in and attacked them and said, you know, this is a very dark and disgusting and unpleasant topic. And it's really off topic to this forum because we're here to figure out how to, you know, build businesses and equity and venture capital and communities. And so, you know, I think you need to go away. So I jumped on and I said, well, you know, I don't disagree that, you know, I agree that this is a dark and sometimes disgusting topic. But the reality is one of the biggest obstacles between us and making local communities wonderful is mind control programming. I mean, mind control programming has stood as an obstacle just about every time I've tried to do anything effective in terms of building community, and it's really, really an issue. So if we're going to get from here to an economy that has a positive total economic return, then we've got to deal with mind control, because people can rig profits for themselves in ways that's very negative for everybody else using mind control. Now, I'm going to say something which I hope doesn't cause offense to some of the people on this call. It's important to understand that every person here, and I hate the word victim, you know, there's a rule generally around me, nobody's allowed to use the V word, but every person on this call, every one of us has been a victim of mind control programming. It's something that affects you, it affects your family, it affects your neighbors, it affects your colleagues, it affects your fellow citizens. You have and you are losing time and money today as a result of mind control in a whole variety of ways. Now, there are theoretically thousands of ways mind control can impact us, and many of us don't understand them. So there's enormous resistance to facing the extent to which we've lost time and money. Sometimes it's too overwhelming. It's too hard to fathom that people would really do this. It is important to understand that the more we become literate in the topic of mind control, the more powerful we become to protect our time, our health, our money. And the best thing about learning about mind control and sort of going through that dark place is that you discover a lot about the power of your mind and of shared intelligence. And so the funny thing is, the more you discover about it, the more you realize, the best way to protect your mind from being controlled or influenced by mind control is to learn how to help your mind, you know, enjoy its greatest potential and power. When you get into sort of the mind empowerment aspect of things, you start to learn a lot about shared intelligence. I put up on, and you can get a link, if you go to the resource category on this Solari report at the at your subscriber cart, we put up a link, and there's a complete list of my recommended information sources. It's books, movies, documentaries, articles, websites on both mind control and what I would call mind empowerment, because it's impossible to understand mind control until you understand sort of intelligence, shared intelligence, and how powerful our minds are, because part of mind control is preventing us from getting together and using our shared intelligence in very powerful ways. And before we start going through I want to start on the history of mind control. I just want to tell you a few stories about how I discovered a lot of what I believe about shared intelligence. It was in the early 90s. I had started Hamilton Securities and was, of course, working round the clock, and so I was driving home at about 11 o'clock at night, and I was listening to a wonderful book called The Dancing Woolly Masters, which is sort of to help the average person understand quantum physics. And it was discussing a experiment that had been done in the early 80s by a group of physicists who proved that two atoms that were further apart from each other than the distance of sound and light acted in concert together, evidencing the properties of a shared intelligence. And it was so amazing, an amazing moment. I got out of the car and started walking up and down the side of the road screaming, "I knew it, I knew it, I knew it." Anyway, one of the things that Hamilton did was we tried to map out how the money worked and the interaction between private and government money within communities. Essentially, American breaks down into 3,100 counties. And what I wanted to see was, what is the GNP and the financial ecosystem of a county, and where is the opportunity to re-engineer the money in ways that builds new wealth? And one of the things I discovered was that the behavior of the financial flows and the money in places represented two things. One, obviously, it represented all sorts of government sort of and centralized rigging. But if you looked at sort of the non-rigged aspect of the economy, it very much behaved in accordance with theories called morphogenic fields. And if you read, I put up on the recommended list a book by Rupert Sheldrake called Presence of the Past, which was one of the books that Sheldrake, who's a biologist in England, used to describe his theory of how shared intelligence works. And sort of what Sheldrake says is our bodies are, you know, think of your brain as like a processor in a computer, but your databases are not in your brain. They're shared in these fields, a field being an invisible field of influence like a gravity field, which he calls morphogenic fields. And later, another book that's listed at the recommended links is a book called The Field by Lynn McTaggart. And McTaggart goes out as a reporter and goes out, sort of covers all the research on morphogenic fields and other theories of shared intelligence. And she's got a new book called The Intention Experiment, where she's trying to test out our ability to literally build fields together and, you know, in a way that can kind of shift the state of things. Anyway, and so as I learned more and more about the relationship between money and shared intelligence, I started to understand the extent to which mind control and sort of the use of financial systems in combination with mind control had really throttled down on the many of the positive things that could be happening in communities and in economies, and made me realize the incredible opportunity if somehow we could change the model. And finally, I put up in that list a story or a link to a story I put up in the blog under the title Karma Means You Don't Get Away With Anything. And it's a perfect little story to give you a hint of the power of the field. It's the story of a woman who killed her best friend so that she could marry her best friend's wealthy husband and came to Jung many years later and explained from the moment she killed her husband on, or she killed her best friend so she could get her husband, from that time on, wherever she was, the birds would stop singing. She said the birds knew. And so if you dig in and you start to look at what is available and what we know and what we understand about shared intelligence, whether of all humans or all living things, what they will tell you is there's a lot more going on and there's a lot more power that's there. And in part, I think some of the mind control we're seeing is because a few people can't control many who have that kind of mental power unless they have a way to block everyone from getting together and building new fields. I'll never forget, I was working with a contractor in the mid-90s who did a lot of work with the CIA, and I started talking with him about morphogenic fields, and he said, you know, the intelligence agencies and the leadership is just terrified of morphogenic fields because people could get together and, come to a consensus that was against them. And I said, okay, well, I guess the battle's on. Anyway, so as I said before, one of the best ways you can protect your mind from being controlled is to learn about the opportunities to bring our minds to the greatest potential. Okay, now the history of mind control is very, very old. When you start to read and learn about mind control, you usually end up reading, starting with the Nazis and coming forward into the United States and going into the U.S. military and intelligence communities. But in fact, that's part of a relatively recent history. And if you want to understand mind control, you need to go much further back. One of the original stories is you can trace back to the Templars bringing to the West the technology they learned from a group called, I hope I pronounced this right, the Assassins. It's the word that the assassins come from, or the word assassin comes from. But literally, you had Middle East cultures who had learned how to take children when they were very young, bring them into a place that was very resource rich, and train them to literally want to be part of, you know, some people would call it the cult and the group, and persuade them that the way they could earn their way back into this wonderful world that they'd been part of as a child was to do the bidding of the politicians, including assassinations, and persuade them that literally if they died it didn't matter because they'd get back into the same heaven. And it's not unlike the story of Daniel in the Bible, the idea of taking young children and teaching them, you know, using mind control to teach them to do extraordinary things. If you trace that technology coming back with the Templars, what you soon learn is that the mind control technology has been part of secret societies and intergenerational family management for many, many centuries. It's literally a way for certain groups of people to create intergenerational loyalty and to keep secrets and to create a cult that's very powerful, and it goes back, you know, long ago. What we saw happen in the 20th century was we saw the addition to that tradition of very significant government funding, first by the Nazis, who had the scientific resources of using people from the camps to accelerate their research. And then after that, many of those scientists were brought to the United States with the help of government funding. And you see tremendous government money being poured into mind control research, both at the universities and by the intelligence agencies and the military. So you see incredible money coming in. Now, I know many of the Salieri Report subscribers have heard me talk again and again and again about the importance of non-transparent money to the course of events, and we created the National Security Act in 1947, then the CIA Act in 1949, and then finally in 1980, an executive order that permitted a lot of government money to be, it made private contractors eligible to do highly classified military and intelligence work. And the combination of those two laws and executive orders literally creates non-transparent funding for private corporations to do things like build mind-controlled assassins. And you've also probably heard me talk about the problem that the government lost control of the technology. Well, part of it was because you have this non-transparent source of money financing corporations who have no responsibility to report to Congress and can take this unbelievably powerful technology and use it. It's funny, I often get, you'll often see debates between people talking about, well, what caused Kennedy to be assassinated? Was it really his pulling out or planning to pull out of Vietnam? Was it firing Alan Dulles over the Bay of Pigs, or was it moving to issue his own currency? And one of the little known facts is that Kennedy was very disgusted about the idea of using government money to create mind-controlled sex slaves and using those sex slaves to provide sex slaves to people like Alan Dulles. And it wouldn't surprise me if, of all the things that Kennedy did, that's the one that gave the most offense. In 1974, we had something called the Church Committee, and the Church Committee and some of the subsequent reports, including a report by Sam Irvin, which is up on the list at the mind control information that I provided, gave it was sort of the last attempt by Congress to really understand what in the world the intelligence agencies were doing with mind control, not just in terms of using mind control programmers as agents or program people as agents, but in terms of studying this technology to see how they could use subliminal programming, entrainment technology, other technology to institute mind control on a much wider scale with the general population or groups of people. And some of that material is worth reading because it gives you a sense of where they were in the early 70s, and you can imagine they've had another 40 years since then with really unlimited funding. One of the books that came out of that period was a book by Walter Bovaart called Operation Mind Control, which is really one of the best books on mind control, and I recommend it to you. The other book I strongly recommend, and probably the one I'd start with if I started with any, would be Secret Don't Tell by Carla Emery, which includes in the appendix a chronology of mind control that's very good. And I'm someone who I can digest a history much faster if I start with a chronology, and it's got a very good one. Now, there are plenty of other good books, but this is an area where there are hundreds of bad books, and you have to wade yourself through a lot of sort of tough information. More recent information, Nick Beglich is the son of a former congressman, and he's got a website called Earth Pulse and has very good information both on mind control and mind potential, mind empowerment. And he has some more of the recent information. Anyway, as a result of the Church Committee in Irvine, we got the books like Walter's, which is quite good. Rockefeller came in, did a commission, hushed everything up. The Colby was the director at CIA. He got thrown out because he was talking too much. And George H.W. Bush came in and put the kibosh down, and so everything got hushed up. And it's remained surprisingly hushed up since then. What we did see is in the 90s, as the money pulled out of the country, we had whistleblowers start to come forward. And what was unusual is that they weren't getting killed. You had whistleblowers coming forward, writing about some of the stuff was going on. You had a lot of movies start to come out on mind control. And for some reason, a decision clearly had been made to let this stuff start to come out into the popular mind. And then with the internet, we have seen we've seen a lot more come out and be discussed as people can connect the dots, share experiences, and everything else. There's an awful lot of stuff on the internet. There's an awful lot of disinformation, so you have to be careful. If you look at the list of movies at the list that I provided for information, I'm going to discuss some of them in our discussion. The two I recommend that you watch are Manchurian Candidate, the remake, 2004 with Denzel Washington, and Telephone. Both are about programmed assassination or assassins, and they're a little sort of graphic, and they only relate to one particular kind of mind control. But I think they do a very good idea of showing you sort of one aspect of mind control programming. My understanding is the technology of what it takes to create a programmed operator or completely mind control program person is much less than it used to. So if you look at Telephone and the Manchurian Candidate, they're implying something that's fairly expensive and requires a lot of experts and is time consuming. There's a lot of indications to believe that it can be done much faster now, particularly with children and people who are young. So let's go through that's sort of a quick overview of the history. Let's go through the types of mind control so that you have a framework of the different kinds of things that go on. And I want to divide it into three areas, the first one being physical body aspects of mind control, the second being the programmed mind control, which is kind of visible intervention, and then finally I want to talk about invisible mind control. And one of the things to understand about mind control is, even though I'm going to talk about all the different kinds, a lot of these things get combined in ways that are very powerful. So it's not just the individual types, but it's the combination of different ones together. Okay, first of all, physical body aspects of mind control I describe as anything that's impacting your body in a way that could either impact your mind or make it easier to impact your mind. And I'm going to divide all of these three categories into both direct and indirect. Okay, so what would be a direct way that something could be done to your physical body to encourage or create mind control. One is implants and chips. There's up at my list of information, there's a little video from Aaron Rousseau describing how one of the members of the Rockefeller family explained to them why they wanted to put chips in people's bodies, so implant a chip into every body connected to an ID card system and use it to do a digital currency so that literally if you don't behave, you can have your money turned off. Well, that's not the only use of those kinds of implants and chips. They can also be used to impact what you think, how you feel, create pain, create pleasure. It's an unbelievably invasive technology. One of the writers and aspects of it, or experts on it, is a woman named Catherine Albrecht, who has her own website, and I listed one of her books up there, and I recommend her to you. She's interviewed in Aaron's documentary From Freedom to Fascism, and that's I recommend you exploring her work. It's sort of very dark stuff, but the reality is, this is a technology which is available, and the reality is the more the leadership gets away with mind control, the more that mind control works for them, the more they're willing and will really do this stuff if they're not stopped. I noted just this week it's reported that Verichip, the leading implant company, has now just bought a medical records company. You can't get more obvious than that. Okay, so that's direct. Indirect, very important. Deteriorate your body's ability. All you have to do is lower a person's immune system or increase their toxicity to make you much more susceptible to other mind control technology, whether direct or indirect. Under this category, I would include vaccines, fluoridation in the water, MSG, sugar, processed food, legal and illegal drugs, biowarfare, various low-grade viruses. Chemtrails is a big question mark. Watch The Killer at Large. It's a great new documentary. It's not new. I think it's 2006. Or Supersize Me, or another one, Under Our Skin, about Lyme disease. What you realize is the extent to which Killer at Large is a perfect example. It's a documentary on obesity, and particularly obesity in children, and it really goes through the politics of agribusiness and the politics in Washington of intentionally poisoning our children with food that they know will literally kill their ability to think and reason. It's a remarkably well done, and you see how intentional and clear everyone is about this. And it's important to remember, the people engaged in doing this don't ask the question, how do I weaken them? They ask the question, how do I make money weakening them? And Killer at Large is a great, really tells that story without saying it that obviously. Okay, so that's indirect, and what you watch is you watch the dumbing down of America. The dumbing down of America is very much dependent on the weakening of immune systems and the increasing of toxicity. Okay, programmed mind control. Now, when people talk about mind control, programmed mind control is usually what you sort of get described to you. And that's visible intervention to interfere with an individual's or group of people's mind. The direct mind control, and we saw this in mentoring candidate and telethon, is it's really a kind of criminal hypnosis is what, say, Carla Emery would describe it. But through a variety of sort of abusive and invasive tactics, you get a person to create multiple personalities. And so in Manchurian Candidate, we have the Denzel Washington character really trained to assassinate and not even know he's been trained to assassinate. He has dreams, but he can't remember. And he's also trained to commit suicide after he assassinates. So you have, you have one person who seems like a loyal, hardworking, responsible soldier, and within that person is what's called a sleeper, or somebody who's capable of doing an assassination. Now, when you think of it, you can see why this got started and made sense. We have reports in World War II of covert operations people, both assassination or courier or other kinds of covert operators, using mind control, because think of it, you know, they get caught and they can't spill the beans on what they know because they can't remember that they know it. And so, you know, in some sense, it makes total sense. The problem is, of course, that technology then starts to be abused in ways that don't relate to just in times of war for something completely in the national security interest. Another kind of mind control programming we see in both the La Femme Nikita TV series, or in Total Recall is probably the most famous one with Arnold Schwarzenegger, where literally memories can be erased. So in La Femme Nikita, a citizen stumbles into a covert operation, learns too much about secret classified information. The question is, do they have to kill the person or can they let them go? And the decision is, we can let them go, just erase their memory. One of the things you see in all of these discussions is certain people are much more susceptible to this kind of programming than others, the easiest one being children. And one of the reasons that children are so good for many of sort of these roles as mind-controlled, whether it's assassins, couriers, sex slaves, is literally the wider population can't fathom that a child is trained to kill. So you can imagine a child goes into a building, kills somebody, comes out, and can't remember that they killed them, and can't remember who told them to kill them. And, of course, no one can fathom that that child is a killer, and so, you know, they can get away with it. So it's, you can imagine in many situations how powerful that kind of thing is. A note on sex slaves. Sex slaves, again, particularly children, are very, very important to creating entrapment and control files. If you have pictures of a senator, a congressman, a bank chairman having sex with a seven-year-old, you know, videotapes of that, then I can assure you, you can have them do whatever you want. You can, you know, and it's not going to cost you a dime. All you need is that tape. So now one of the things that you'll often see is people who track and research mind control, trying to figure out how many people have been through this kind of mind control programming, direct mind control. And you'll see estimates of as much as 500,000 to 2 million people. I would submit to you that is not an unreasonable estimate. I think the numbers are far higher than you might guess. And that includes a lot of people that you think of as being very powerful and in the elites. It's very hard. I mean, if you think about this as a matter of money and investment, why would you ever let somebody become the president of a bank or the president of the United States unless you had this kind of control? You just can't afford to spend $1 billion to get somebody elected to president and not have this kind of, you know, trap door in their mind to make sure they don't go off hog wild thinking that they're really in control. So, and especially with the programming getting faster and faster, you know, it's a little bit scary to realize how much of this may be out here in the United States, and that doesn't even include globally, nor the fact that, you know, this technology has not limited itself to governments and military and intelligence communities. One of the movies I listed was a movie called Zoolander, which talks about this kind of stuff being used by organized crime. When you read Carla Emery, you know, there's a history of criminal hypnosis being used by organized crime for centuries now. And I suspect one of the reasons that a lot of the whistleblowers and information about this may have been allowed to get out in the 90s is the military and intelligence couldn't stop this from spreading widely by, you know, sort of mafia worldwide and corporations worldwide. And ultimately, the only protection against this is if the population is much more knowledgeable about it. Okay, so under the second category of programming, we've been discussing direct. Let's talk about indirect. Indirect would include both media and education. When you take children and you put them in a classroom and spend years and years and years telling them stories or histories that don't really match up with the facts, you get the kind of dumbing down that people are concerned about. There are a lot of great books on dumbing down, and I didn't include them in the list that I gave. It's a whole other topic. But it is very serious, especially when you combine it with the other forms of mind control that are going on. And media, one of the documentaries I did include is a wonderful documentary done by Adam Curtis for the BBC called Century of Self, and I strongly recommend it. It's just so outstanding. It's a history of all the research done into how to manipulate people, how to manipulate opinions, how to manipulate advertising, political campaigns. And when I tell you that billions and billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars of taxpayer money has been spent to figure out how to do this, it's quite extraordinary that any of us are in our right minds still. But one of the things it shows is the extent to which political choice and power have been gradually replaced by consumer choice and power. And so literally, you know, a whole population was lulled into not caring that they didn't have political power anymore because they had such infinite consumer choice and were being sort of catered to by quote-unquote consumer power, not realizing that ultimately those choices in power could be seriously diminished if not removed, and that what they were giving away was sort of the equity and power you need to have those choices if they're economically feasible. So it's a pretty remarkable documentary, and I recommend it strongly to you. Okay, another example, of course, then, is from government, things like the war on terror. So use fear as really, because fear is remarkable in getting us to shut down our mind and not, you know, perfect example was what I described earlier under money markets, this new announcement from the CIA this week that Al-Qaeda was set to attack just as the market approached sinking below the $10,000 floor. And I tried to explain to someone today that had happened, and literally he thought it was a spoof. He said, "Is that from The Onion," which is a website that spoofs these things? And I said, "No, this is real." Okay, so I've been through the first two categories. I've been through the physical body aspects of mind control, both direct and indirect. I've been through the programming, direct and indirect, and then finally I want to talk about the area that's really hardest to get the good information on. But I think we need to talk about it anyway. You can't wait for great information, and that is invisible mind control, mind control that occurs literally through the air, through the airwaves. You can't see it, and it's hard to get information on it, but it's very there. Okay, so again, direct and indirect categories. The direct category is entrainment and subliminal programming. Most of you have heard me tell the story. I was sitting on Wall Street in 1984 and overheard a conversation between some very powerful people that I was not supposed to overhear about the entrainment and subliminal programming that was going to be rolled out on television, and it scared me to death. And ladies and gentlemen, I want to tell you, I don't scare easily, but that one scared me to death. And it was literally the last time that was it for me and TV. That's when TV went out of my life. And now, even then, that was quite an adjustment for me. It took me about a year and a half to literally adjust to living without a TV. And I haven't owned one since, except for a brief time in the administration. When I was in the Bush administration, somebody went out and said, "You can't work for government and not have a TV," and bought me one. But as soon as I left the administration, I gave it away. There's a movie in the list of movies called Videodrome, which is an absolutely dreadful movie. But it does a great job of explaining to you in a very dramatic way why you might want to consider not watching television. And I know you need the sports, but be careful. It's not just TV. It's literally anything, any sort of media, entertainment media. I took in 1998, I took a wonderful course at an African American church in Washington on spiritual warfare and got a load of sort of information on subliminal programming in music and CDs. And, you know, I heard all of this. I was very skeptical. I said, "This can't be." And so I started to listen to popular CDs to kind of listen to the subliminal. Sometimes you can hear the subliminal programming, sort of underneath the thread. And I thought, oh dear, this is real. really real. But I suspect we're probably dealing with it in the radio, internet, you know, iPhones, cell phones, movies. One of the most dangerous ones, I think, and I don't know a lot about it, but I'm assured that it's true, is video games. You know, it's pretty scary what we're watching our children do with video games. And you're literally, there was all sorts of sort of mind control programming that was used to teach children how to be assassins. And to get them sort of immune to watching blood and guts. And you'll see very similar kind of programming used on video games, so it's a little bit scary. One of my big questions is about cell towers and cell phone systems. You know, I think the potential for mind control, misuse, and damage there is extraordinary. Again, very hard to get information on it. Now, all of this kind of entrainment, subliminal programming, is very, very dangerous when you can combine it with a variety of covert operations. So, when you can combine surveillance systems and getting that kind of information with the ability to use these things to feedback and control, particularly in situations where you've got a team of operators trying to influence a company's behavior or a municipality's behavior. So, for example, you're Enron. You're trying to get the Indian government to do what you want. You're using echelon teams to listen to all their conversations. You have access to entrainment, subliminal programming to, you know, to impact them when you call them on the phone, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so the, you can imagine the business applications of a combination of these technologies. Okay, so that's entrainment and subliminal programming. A second area of, in the direct category is non-lethal weapons. I put up a link on the mind control information to the Wikipedia entry on non-lethal weapons. What has been growing since the late 80s is tremendous investment by both military and then military and the Department of Justice for enforcement application in this country, using sound weapons, using light weapons, using directed energy weapons. So all things that are invisible. I mentioned this in my blog post, but when I first started to research this in the 1990s, I started to find examples of literally landlords using these weapons to sort of age older people or literally get them to lose their minds so that they could move them from rent-controlled apartments where they were getting, say, $400 to $800 a month into assisted living because they could get $2,000 a month for the same person. Gloria Naylor, who's a remarkable writer, just one of my favorite writers before I even knew about this or how she did it, became a target of non-lethal weaponry in the 90s. Including weapons that literally can enter, they're very invasive, they can enter your mind and insert thoughts or feelings into you, into your mind and sort of your spirit. And she became the target of this, and very amazing person with great faith, and was able to finally figure out what was going on and wrote a book about it that was, it's just a remarkable, remarkable book and it's really describes one aspect of non-lethal weapons and the damages they can do to one person. Now, many of these weapons have been developed to impact crowds. And, of course, again, remember, these guys always prototype on individuals technologies that they want to adapt to crowds or much wider groups. So 1996 is really worth reading to get a sense of what some of the of this technology can do. Okay, item number three, psychic warfare. Now, as you may know, whenever George Clooney makes a movie, it's very likely that I'm going to love it. And he had a wonderful movie called The Men Who Stare at Goats about the remote viewing and some of the psychic warfare that the military has done. And what does it, you get a sense for what psychic warfare might be from watching the movie. What it doesn't describe is literally, such things exist as defense contractors who use psychics and literally they're hired to engage in psychic warfare against people, and that psychic warfare can have an impact. You know, I almost have a picture of a bunch of guys sitting around in military with a voodoo doll. So it sounds silly, but when you combine it with other mind control technologies, so you can do similar things but electronic, and it gets back to the non-lethal weapons, directed energy through satellites that target individuals, then you can get into some pretty ugly and weird stuff. So again, that's it for direct. So under direct, invisible mind control, we have entrainment and subliminal programming, non-lethal weapons, and psychic warfare. Indirect is something even more subtle, which is when you're living among people who are heavily programmed with these methods, and you're not, you get into sort of these situations like the character who enters the Stepford Wives community, and all the other women are programmed and she's not, and it seems very weird. And the best example I can give you of this day to day is I often, for many years, I would ask an audience who came to hear me speak, how many of you watch TV? And what I discovered was my audience was people who don't watch TV, because literally I'd get an audience of 100 to 1,000 people, and pretty much, you know, maybe 5 to 10% watch TV. And if you're in a room with 1,000 people who don't watch TV, it is an unbelievably different feeling and an unbelievably different conversation than being in a room with 1,000 people, you know, who watch 3 hours a day of television. And so because we do share intelligence, if you're very much impacted by the field of, the people you're around. And one of the reasons I now want to live in a place where there's very high concentration of trees and animals and nature is it's very grounding. And, the cows and the ducks and the horses don't watch TV. The trees don't watch TV, and somehow it seems to balance it out. Okay, so that's it for the sort of the areas of mind control. Let's talk a little bit about day-to-day applications and what this all means to you. And, I would just say that if you're interested in exploring mind control, you know, I'd start with some of the documentaries and movies, read some of the books, particularly the books on shared intelligence. Good place to start is The Field by Lynn McTaggart. And, and just start to explore this slowly and get your mind around what is really going on. But it's all going to come down to day-to-day application. So let me just talk a little bit about this. There are three things you really need to be successful as, according to how you define success. One is you need an accurate map of your world. You need to understand your world and what's going on around you so that you can make intelligent choices. The second thing is when you act, you want to act in a way where your time is effective to accomplish whatever your purpose is. And the third thing is you have assets, you manage assets, you want to be able to protect and manage those assets intelligently. And so mind control is something that can create risk to you in all of these things. And the question is, by understanding mind control, how can you protect yourself in these three aspects? So let me go through them and make a few suggestions. One of the things to build a sound map of our world, it's very important to understand that mind control is having a very profound impact on the events around us. First of all, if I'm right, many of our leaders are heavily mind controlled, whether it's direct or indirect. And they're also managing in a world where this technology allows very powerful people to kill with impunity. So if you watch Manchurian Candidate, we have this Hillary Clinton lookalike senator, and the extent to, which she's a lookalike is really kind of amazing. And she's teamed up with a Carlisle-like investment firm called Manchurian Global. I kind of wonder how this all got out, what the Pentagon was trying to communicate to Hillary Clinton and the Carlisle Group at the time. But and so we have this senator who doesn't fear a criminal investigation or any liability from ordering the murder of another senator, because the person she's ordering to kill that senator, which is her son, can't remember that he killed him, and the senator's daughter as well, and can't remember who told him to do so. You know, so when, you know, think about it, when different groups of leaders start fighting with each other and they have these kinds of assassins on their, you know, as part of their portfolio of tools, war, you know, different fights can get very, very ugly. And if you're a senator or a congressman, you've got to think twice about irritating the owners of the New York Fed. And it would help to explain the arrogance of a Geithner or Summers. They represent people who have this kind of amazing force and weaponry. And what they've watched and that group has watched for many decades is, you know, mind control works. They have the ability to sort of turn on the machinery, whether it's individual operatives or just the media or, you know, whatever entrainment, subliminal programming they're doing on TV, et cetera. And sure enough, they can swing the crowd that way. It works. And the more it works, of course, the less they respect the people who are being manipulated. You can see it in the killer at large. They're, you know, they're sitting there sort of engineering policies that are literally killing children. And they're laughing about it. They think it's funny. And it's making them money. And they have absolutely, you know, no caring for the children that they're literally killing. They think it's funny. And so what you've had is this cycle of disrespect, because the more you can manipulate and the more you get away with it and the more it works, the less you respect the people you can manipulate. But they have gotten away with it. And, you know, so it's important if you can appreciate that cycle of disrespect and you can appreciate the risk that anybody who governs real assets is running given this kind of technology, it helps you to kind of see what's really going on. And, you know, it helps you to understand why every time somebody says, well, let's go talk to our congressman, you know, you have to understand the position that that congressman is in. You know, he could have a control file created by an entrapment set up with a mind control person. He could be afraid of mind control manipulation or assassination. He could be mind controlled, you know, on and on and on. Anyway, what are the things you can do? One of the things you can do is you can reduce technologies using subliminal programming. So think seriously about giving away your TV. Have redundant and trustworthy sources. Never be dependent on any particular source. Check and double check. There's a lot to be said for shared intelligence. Give things time. If you want to learn about a thing going on, you know, give yourself time, read, think. Don't be quick to come to decisions. You know, really dig in and beware the popular view. Try to learn how to spot the applications of mind-controlled operations around you. For example, narcotics trafficking is one of the most powerful businesses in this country. It's, you know, it's very much run one county at a time. Those kind of operations and that kind of money laundering can't go on without mind control. You know, so maybe try and see, you know, see it around you, and to help you do that, get educated over time. The movies and books, the documentaries are very helpful. My best tool to kind of beat mind control is I use money as a tool. I think, and I would say a mapping tool. If I can understand the financial ecosystem around anything, how the money works, who makes money, who loses money, you know, how the money works, it stops a lot of spin and a lot of lies, because the money ultimately doesn't lie. If you can just watch how the money works over time, you know, the sort of the lies and spin can't trick you. Okay, so let's talk about actions. Organize into small groups that can network. One of the reasons I like to stay away from large groups and formal structures and big ideas is they are so vulnerable to mind control and this kind of covert sabotage. Lots of small informal groups, that's why I like circles, that network informally are much harder and much more expensive to compromise. Be careful, you know, when you start a business to think about how to build internal transparency and redundancy and multiple checks and balances to protect yourself from this kind of sabotage. It's funny, I would not start a business until I could figure out how to do that. And the one thing I missed was I didn't understand something called promise software, which we're not going to talk about tonight, but literally that the government had software that could access multiple bank accounts, at the same time and would actively try and sabotage their own transactions. So, but think about how your business might be vulnerable to this kind of sabotage. And transparency and redundancy does a lot, and also being very thorough and careful about how you build your people and your teams. One of the things I've found is if there's very good balance in a team as to age, as to sex, and something which I call Myers-Briggs profiles, or how people process information, because there are different kinds of people who are more susceptible to being tricked. And so when you have different points of view, different expertises, and sort of a balance of types, it makes a team much more resilient. It's very important to work with people you know and trust and people that the people you know and trust. So there's a vetting process. You want to be careful about people. You want to be careful. You certainly want to take extra precautions with children and grandchildren. Don't let time go unaccounted for. You want to know where they are, who they're with, and you want to make sure there was no time unaccounted for. Keep things simple. Complexity is a great opportunity for mind control. So, for example, in your business or how you manage your assets, if you keep things very simple and very understandable and you make sure you understand, it diminishes the impact that these things can have. Locally, act locally. You know, if you have a group of people and you're all dealing directly with the concrete reality of whatever you're dealing with, it really cuts down on misunderstandings. It really cuts down on lies. There's an accountability because the concrete reality is so real to everybody, and that's one of the reasons that acting locally is so, so important. Understand that a well-armed population may not be that well-armed in a world of mind control and non-lethal weaponry. I'm not saying it's not essential to stay well-armed, but it's important to understand this kind of technology and why it changes the formula or changes sort of the state of play from the way things were 30 years ago. It is so, so important to invest in health and to stay close to nature. Nature is a great protector, and it's critical to keep your immune system strong, reduce toxicity, because all those things make you much more susceptible. It's very important to be careful of drugs and addictions for the same reason drugs, alcohol can also make you more susceptible. Okay, managing assets. One of the reasons I encourage people to understand where their money is going and why, to try and keep their investments as relatively simple as they can, to keep excellent and redundant records, is those are all great approaches to sort of functioning in a world where a financial operation can be susceptible to mind control and the markets can be, can experience mind control. You can't get this kind of financial fraud without mind control going on. One of the reasons I promote the idea of Solari circles, and there's a write-up about Solari circles on the homepage, is small, intimate groups of people that you really know and trust can be smarter together than we can alone and help each other kind of keep and find our balance. Particularly when the world is changing, that's another sort of environment where mind control gets, or that kind of sabotage gets easier. So people you know and trust, you have a history with, or the people you know and trust have a history with, that's really important. One of the things we're often asked is, please won't you help us connect with other people in the Solari network through the internet and forums? And one of the reasons I'm reluctant to do it is government sabotage and various group sabotage. That's an open invitation, and mind control is one of the things they sort of insert in those situations, which is why I'm sort of reluctant to, I just keep encouraging people to network through the people you know and trust. Finally, part of the shift to tangibles, so getting out of paper and shifting to tangibles, is often tangible investment is a lot less susceptible to mind control. It's when you get these very complex and paperful systems that you start to really get into sort of sabotage by mind control. So those are just some quick ideas of how to protect yourself in the areas of sort of understanding your world, taking action, or protecting your assets. But mind control, because mind control programming is real, because it's being used, because the rollout of new technologies is increasing, it's going to pay us to understand it. And the more of us who understand it, the more immune we can become to sort of what's happening. Now, in closing, I just wanted to mention another story about mind control that I really enjoyed. John Rapoport is a wonderful investigative reporter. We've done one Solari report with John. You can go back in the archives and listen. And there's several links from John Rapoport. He's got a wonderful book called The Secret of Secret Societies, which is a terrific book to read to sort of understand the deeper, older mind control issues. John did a series of interviews with a guy named Ellis Medavoy, who'd been a PR communications expert who'd been hired by private groups to basically engineer the kind of propaganda and mind control we're all sort of grappling with. And in one of the interviews, John gets very frustrated and says, well, you know, if you guys were so smart and so stupid, and the top guys can manipulate us and, you know, just trick us every time, what's the point? I guess it's totally hopeless. Why are you bothering to talk to me and, you know, sort of give me all this information since we're so stupid and they're so smart and it's all so hopeless? And Ellis says, well, you know, it's funny. No matter what we did, every time we thought we had just gotten everybody tricked and fooled, something would happen. And it was like the system was more intelligent. The people were more intelligent, and we could never, like, get complete control. There would just be this intelligence which would show up and shift things. And what I finally realized is, you know, when people use their imagination and when they share intelligence, it's too out of control. We could never get complete control. And I read it, and I said, you know, that really is completely true. And what he's describing is that shared intelligence and the power of people's mind and the urgency, you know, the urge we all have to be free, you know, because freedom starts with our minds being free. And so that was one of the great moments when I realized, you know, these guys, I don't care what their technology is, they're never going to get locked down. Now, the reason I want everybody to learn about all this stuff is, you know, their efforts to get locked down will be defeated much faster. One of the things we need, now it's interesting, we have a wonderful member of our network who started sending me when I posted that I was going to do this, sent me all these links on mind control, and in fact a link to Walter Bohart's Operation Mind Control book in PDF, which is part of the links that you have, so you don't have to go out and buy the book, you can just go to the link. And one of the things he said in his last message to me this morning was, he said, let me read it to you, I'm not sure how humanity escapes their grip this time. And he's referring to all the new developments in mind control technology, particularly the invisible ones, he says, but I continue to remain very confident that it will, even though I cannot see the path. Now, in closing, what I'd like to say is that bringing transparency to mind control technology is an important step on creating that path, as is changing our economic model. As soon as we all commit to having a positive total economic return and using transparency to do it, it completely blows a lot of the power of mind control technology out of the water. And it's something we can each begin to do and organize locally and in our networks of trust. And we just have to play by the same rules that they do, which is figure out how we can do it in a way that makes us money. So it's really time to face the facts of mind control and bring it out into the sunshine, because that's part of how we're gonna create a path together. So in closing, I just want to tell you that I'm looking forward to being with you next week on February 11th for the Precious Metals Market Report. We're not going to have a movie because there's so much to talk about in terms of what's going on in the money markets and precious metals that I want to spend the whole time just talking about the precious metals market and making sure that the powers that be don't talk you out of real things that have value into paper that has no value or could tomorrow have no value. Okay, so until February 11th, you are in our prayers. And please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.